Hi, I'm Jeremy Kirk with Intel 471, and welcome to Studio 471, which is our regular video interview series on cybersecurity. There's an increasing number of regulations that are aimed at keeping data local for data protection reasons, but these are having impacts on cybersecurity. With me today is Professor Peter Swire of Georgia Tech's College of Computing. Peter's led a team since 2021 that has published two research papers looking at the effects of these regulations on cybersecurity, including aspects like threat hunting and pen testing. Thank you very much for joining me, Peter.
Glad to be here.
So, just to set the framework for the conversation, can you tell me what are regulators aiming by passing these local data localization processing regulations, and what's that's intended to accomplish?
Well, there can be different motivations. The first one that people think about is they might believe that data will be safer if they keep it in country. So if you're within the European Union, maybe you don't trust your data going to some other country, going to China, Russia, the United States, whoever it is you don't like that day, India. That's one sort of thing. And that way, the idea is if you keep it within the realm of safe countries, countries with strong data protection, then you feel like you've achieved something. There's different reasons. There could be a could be that you're trying the country's trying to write laws that help their local providers and keep the data inside the country. France has some laws that try to say that only local cloud providers can do things, and partly that's to help promote the local cloud providers and fight against the big international hyperscalers. But so what mix of protectionism, honest cybersecurity reasons, or simply the idea of strict data protection? There's different reasons people have put these laws in place.
Let's talk about the GDPR, which is Europe's General Data Protection Regulation. What restrictions does that put on processing around personal data, and how does that impact cybersecurity?
So the first thing under GDPR, under the European law, is processing personal data, a broad term that means data that's connected to a person. Processing about personal data is prohibited in general. It's then allowed if you have a lawful basis, if you have some specific reason why you're able to do it. It might be because you're performing a contract. It might be because the person consented. A lot of times it's done for a legitimate interest that there's a good reason that you're using the data. So that's the baseline. Now, the other big rule in Europe is that there's supposed to be these good data protections all through the 27 member states, all through Europe. But what if the data goes outside to third countries? So if it goes to some country with no privacy protections, there's a concern that maybe the data won't be protected anymore. And there can be things like contracts, standard contract clauses that say the company will still protect it carefully. But even then, it might not be protected, for instance, from government access. So if data goes to China in a database, the Chinese government might get it. If data goes to the United States, there's concerns the US government might get it. So, but the basic story is you can process it if you have a good lawful basis, but you can't transfer it to outside countries, to third countries, unless it's going to be protected well enough.
And let's kind of get into like some types of data that are used like in a threat intelligence context, and then how that intersects with what the EU considers to be personal data. So you've got like location data, IP address, cookie IDs, advertising IDs, MAC addresses. Is that all considered then under GDPR personal data then in certain contexts?
That's personal data. The legal rule is it linkable to an individual? And a lot of times IP address is linkable to an individual. A MAC address of a device is linkable to an individual. So then you're in that category, personal data, and then the various rules apply that says it has to be protected.
Let's talk about that. You mentioned the lawful basis, which I also wanted to get into it. So there seems to be a sort of carve out then that you can use it for some purposes. What sort of, I guess, flexibility, or maybe we should say inflexibility, does that give entities that are handling that sort of information?
Well, so legitimate interest, doing things for a perfectly good, valid business reason, can often include cybersecurity purposes. So Article 32 of GDPR says you're supposed to do good cybersecurity. That makes sense. If you're going to protect the data, if you're going to do data protection, you should stop the bad guys from getting in. So there's a starting point that says cybersecurity is supposed to be usable as a reason to do it. Now, you can only use the data that's strictly necessary for cybersecurity. So you can't say, oh, this might help cybersecurity, so we're going to dump all the data that we have somewhere. But the basic starting point is you're supposed to be able to do cybersecurity. It's just that sometimes maybe that isn't going to work out in practice.
So in the second paper, you look specifically at MITRE ATT&CK and tactics, techniques and procedures in the MITRE framework that would be most likely affected by data localization rules. Tell me about what you found.
Well, so we went at it in various ways. One is just as background. I'm a professor at Georgia Tech with a training in law and lots of time with technology. We had two Georgia Tech co-authors. We also worked with the company CrowdStrike here, which is a cybersecurity company that got famous for the airline stuff and everything else. But that's relevant because we had people who really do major league cybersecurity, including their European lawyer, as part of this to make sure we were being true to how things really worked. So that's some background. But in terms of where does the MITRE framework or where does the codes of conduct in Europe most apply, one issue is threat hunting. Threat hunting is, hey, here's an IP address that's risky, or hey, here's some other signature of some sort, maybe attached to other indicators that might be linkable to people that's risky. Well, the basic rule is you can't send it to third countries unless you have a good basis for doing it. And legitimate interest, that basic idea of, hey, it's a good idea, is not considered a basis to transfer it out of Europe to third countries. And so there's really a question about whether in a global network where you have a company or a system working in different places, whether you can ship that IP address and other data from Europe to the rest of the system. So if you identify a threat in Europe, not clear you can even tell people in the United States, for instance, or Australia, you know, because Australia doesn't have an adequacy decision. It's not clear you can send it to them. So that's the number one, that's threat hunting. A second one we talked about is escalation attacks. So a lot of cybersecurity says, you know, there was a fish, we got to this low-level employee, then it's going to move horizontally in an organization, then it's going to move vertically if they can try to escalate privilege. Well, that's a standard part of cybersecurity is to have pretty strong detection of those intrusions and then detections of unusual activity. So there's an alert to the cybersecurity people. But that only works if you can trace it when it goes horizontally or when it goes vertically. If they jump continents, then maybe it's not permissible to share that. That's the concern about escalation attacks. The third one we talked about is pen testing and red teaming more generally. So the assumption is the attackers, the criminals, the nation states are going to break the rules. They're going to jump across continents to try to hide their tracks. Now you go and hire a pen tester to try to figure out, is your system secure? Well, the pen tester may not have the legal ability to take the things they learned in Europe, let's say, and go to a third country with it. So that means that the attackers who are playing globally will know more than the defenders. The pen testers can't try all the tricks that the attackers are going to use. So those are three things we identified that are, you know, that are motherhood and apple pie. You should have threat hunting. You should have escalation privilege prevention. You should have pen testing. Those are standard things everyone should be doing in a major system. And the localization rules put those in doubt.
There's a good example in the paper involving a spear phishing investigation. Just to drill down a little bit more into sort of how personal data could get involved in that sort of investigation. Tell me about the exercise.
Yeah, well, I think spear phishing can be seen as an example of how privilege escalation happens. So phishing in general is you get somebody to bite for the fish. You get somebody to provide information and let you in, the attacker in, to their part of the system. Spear phishing is the refinement when it's very tailored. Maybe your boss's boss is purporting to send you the thing. So it's more persuasive than some Nigerian prince saying they want to have access to your stuff. Okay, so there's spear phishing. And now after the fish has happened, there's going to be unusual activity to move horizontally and vertically. And the goal for the defenders would be to spot unusual activity. And to do that, you have to say whose account is being used. Are they being used in a way that's not typical for that account? Did it jump to some other weird account over there? What the heck happened? Why is it moving from here to some place that person's never jumped to in the organization? Those are tracking account information, the account names and email addresses and other activity that's linked to individuals. And that if that tracking means it goes across borders, localization may say you can't do that.
And so much of cybersecurity right now is kind of aggregation of indicators and looking for trends. And there's also, you describe in both of the papers, kind of like the impacts on machine learning, right? And so there may be restrictions on aggregation. Can you tell me more about those impacts?
Happily, our third paper will be coming out soon in the Missouri Law Review, which talks more about machine learning and AI in particular, but we foreshadow it in this paper. So the question's going to be, when are you able to take the data from across a lot of different sensors and for machine learning purposes, try to see patterns in that data? And if you cut down the number of sensors that can look at things, we have a model in our paper that was done by the chief data officer for CrowdStrike. So he's a PhD from Georgia Tech, smart guy, Sven Krasser. And the model shows how when you decrease sensors, you decrease the ability to detect compromise even faster than you decrease the number of sensors. So you're restricting the ability of the system to find those things. So in a machine learning world where the bad guys are using machine learning and AI to try to hide, you have to use machine learning and AI to try to detect the bad guys who are hiding. And the concern is going to be whether you can use the sensors in a global way to really spot what's going on.
And the paper also comes to a conclusion about IP addresses, which I found really interesting, and like sort of the number of IP addresses and indicators that go into an investigation and the ability of investigators to sort of resolve that. Tell me about that discovery as well.
I think that's related to the model I was just trying to describe in my lawyer's non-technical way. But whether it's IP addresses or other data sources you have that might be personal data, if you restrict the universe for finding that, it takes longer to find to get above your threshold for saying this is a threat. And so your risk identification is degraded. And the regulators, the people who want to do privacy data protection, the people who want to do cybersecurity, they don't want to degrade cybersecurity. But there's other goals people have. The goal will be, we want to make sure that personal data is handled correctly. We want to make sure it's transferred to unknown countries only if it's handled correctly. Those are understandable instincts. Sometimes, as I said, it might be protectionist. We don't want those other countries to have the benefit of doing the service. And this is not just a Europe thing. Pakistan has data localization. Dozens of countries have passed data localization. Even the United States has started to put limits on some data going to China, and China has very strict limits on cybersecurity information going from China to other places. So there's a big, complicated world. There's a lot of limits on data flows. It's not the internet from the 1990s where everything was supposed to go everywhere. But the thing that we're saying is, the thing we're emphasizing is, for good faith cybersecurity purposes, which are there to protect data, that we should look long and hard at these localization rules and sort of see where the risk is that they might be degrading things. And maybe there's reasons that are good for localization. We're not saying we have a global wisdom about all rules for localization, but we say that if you stop the cybersecurity defenders from using the data, that it's likely to undermine cybersecurity. And if it's done in the name of privacy and data protection, you should be especially worried to make sure those rules are not getting in the way of protecting the data. And that's part of why we focus on Europe, because the data protection rules are strict, and we don't want to have these unplanned effects on degrading cybersecurity.
And I should note, just going back to the model that you mentioned as well, there was a really kind of striking way that it was described in the paper too. It says in the model, having the number of IP addresses available to a defender would more than double the likely time until a new attack is detected. And of course, that is quite serious when you're looking at dwell time and trying to detect attackers in that dwell time before they do something more malicious. Just to talk about kind of more big picture too, did you get the sense that cybersecurity companies are pulling back then a little bit or not sharing as much as a result of these protection regulations, or is it still kind of a very murky area in the law and there's yet to be any sort of marquee enforcement action that's taken place yet?
It's hard for me to assess what all the different cybersecurity companies are doing. They're not coming out and saying, hey, we would have done good cybersecurity, but now we're not. That's not your big advertising, angle usually. But there was a case in Portugal for Cloudflare. And Cloudflare had a contract to do cybersecurity for a government agency in Portugal. It was the census. That's pretty sensitive data. And to do that, they were sending IP address information back to the United States, where Cloudflare had its data center. The data protection supervisor in Portugal said, this is unacceptable. We can't have these IP addresses going to the United States. So it's IP addresses, which are bread and butter for lots and lots of cybersecurity purposes, and only IP addresses. And it was being done to protect cybersecurity. And there was an enforcement action that said to Cloudflare, we're canceling your contract. So that really was part of how we got into this area. When you see real live enforcement actions stopping a good faith cybersecurity company from providing cybersecurity. And sometimes, you know, there's a lot of countries in the world, a lot of countries don't have state-of-the-art cybersecurity services. I mean, you're in Australia and there's some countries that have really, really good cybersecurity services. If you localize, you might be picking the third best or the fifth best service if only in your country you have services that aren't that good. So cutting off global access to the best cybersecurity services weakens the whole system, and that's something to be concerned about.
The paper says that the number of data localization measures roughly doubled between 2018 and 2021. It says including at least 62 countries with 144 different restrictions. Do you expect this to get stricter and more complicated then?
Yeah, you know, usually regulatory systems get stricter. They don't get, you know, they don't get simpler usually. And a lot of countries are facing a lot of different pressures to put some rules around data crossing borders. You know, they're scared of China, they're scared of the United States, they're scared of something else. And so the numbers have gone up. Those numbers were not from our study. Those numbers came from a study by a guy named Nigel Corey, who's done careful work documenting some of the spread of these localization rules. But, you know, if you think of the old internet where every data flows everywhere and we had one ICANN that worked for everybody with root servers that were the same everywhere, we're in a sort of great power confrontation era, in an era where there's so much riding on what gets done on the internet. Countries are coming up with more reasons to limit data flows. And when they do it, part of our message is, hey, don't accidentally wreck your cybersecurity because you have some other goal in mind. So if the work's being done for real cybersecurity purposes, and you can show that that's what's going on, do the threat hunting, stop the privilege escalation, you know, do the pen testing. These are basic measures that everyone should be doing in their systems. We're saying don't, in the name of something else, inadvertently screw up cybersecurity. And we've tried to take the time to get very concrete by showing how, you know, codes of conduct, good practices, the MITRE framework, the things that cybersecurity professionals live with every day. In our other article, we talked about ISO 27001 and 002, which is a standard for cybersecurity, what a cybersecurity program is supposed to look like. So we're taking the best known cybersecurity standards and showing how localization rules can get in the way of putting good practices in place.
And it doesn't matter.
Yeah, we hope that won't happen. We hope the enforcement people won't keep doing what they did to Cloudflare in that example.
Yeah.
But unless somebody raises the alarm, the rules might prohibit it, or people might think the rules prohibit it, and then they're not putting good cybersecurity in place.
Is it as simple as writing that carve out into the legislation itself? Or is there something else that has to be done to kind of separate, okay, well, you're an advertiser and advertising IDs can be, of course, they're, you know, they're identifiers that are very sensitive, but that is clearly for not a cybersecurity purpose. So that should be under the stricter regime than something for that, cybersecurity.
Part of what we say in the paper is, you shouldn't use cybersecurity as an excuse for other stuff such as advertising. You don't take your cybersecurity database, say, yeah, we're cybersecurity, and then use it to do surveillance on people or advertising on people. You should use it in European legal terms. The cybersecurity information should be necessary. You really need it to do the cybersecurity, and proportionate. So if you need this much data, you don't get, you know, teraflops of data. You know, you get the data you need for cybersecurity. That's what we're saying. And we're saying to cybersecurity companies, if you show that you have a reasonable basis for what you're doing, that you're not spreading identifiers around in ways that themselves are insecure, if you're using it to protect cybersecurity. So basically, it's one more area where sort of reasonable care or due diligence or common sense kicks in. If you do it like that, we think that you should be able to do your cybersecurity. And we hope that regulators aren't going to come in and mess it up. But because the laws sometimes are vague and people haven't thought about it, when people write the laws, it can have the effect of seeming to say you can't do cybersecurity. And once you say IP addresses are personal data and all the privacy laws apply, then a lot of logging, a lot of basic cybersecurity gets called into question. And we don't want companies and agencies thinking they have to close down good practices. So we're trying to raise the issue, get to a common sense answer, get the privacy regulators, the cybersecurity regulators, the good faith government people to say, yeah, like, don't worry about that. There's other privacy issues to worry about. Cybersecurity people, do your job. And we hope if cybersecurity people are doing their job, they won't get hit sideways by these regulatory problems.
And let's not make CTI illegal, as you alluded to before we started chatting.
Right. Right. Yeah. You know, sometimes a role for research is to show a problem that if we don't get to common sense, the problem could get worse. And we hope that what we're doing here is helping people get to common sense answers. But there have been in other enforcement cases. You know, people have gone after Google Analytics for only IP addresses. That's not mostly a cybersecurity thing, but there's other enforcement actions just around IP addresses. And the lawyers for cybersecurity companies can look at that and start to get nervous. We're trying to help create legal arguments and a sort of common sense structure to avoid those kind of negative consequences.
Excellent. Well, Peter, thank you so much for joining me. I really appreciate your insights.
Great, Jeremy. Good to talk today.